President Janet Murguia, the shock that President Obama expressed when they called him the deporter in chief.
Yeah, well, I mean, look at the record. It was an empirically verifiable claim that they put forward. And did the White House expect that the price of support for certain issues and being a symbolic representative of minorities would be the silence and the muting, silencing and the muting of the voice? That would be pretty ridiculous, and that has to be pushed back on. And I think that when she made that statement and others among African Americans who pushed back even gently, there was obvious resentment for that and resistance to that. But the job of a social and cultural critic is to put that forth.
Well, we have to break here, but we're going to continue the conversation, and we'll post it at democracynow.org. Michael Eric Dyson, our guest, Georgetown University professor, his book, The Black Presidency, Barack Obama and the Politics of Race in America. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next, we're going to talk about the Constitution. The number to call in, 503-231-8187. But first, some announcements.
Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of This Changes Everything, Tuesday, February 9th, 6:30 p.m. at the Multnomah Arts Center Auditorium in Portland. This Changes Everything is a film directed by Avi Lewis and inspired by Naomi Klein's international bestseller of the same title that attempts to reimagine the vast challenge of climate change.
I've spent 6 years wandering through the wreckage caused by the carbon in the air and the economic system that put it there.
There will also be information and representatives from local groups involved in the climate change struggle. Again, that's Tuesday, February 9th, 6:30 p.m. at the Multnomah Arts Center Auditorium, 7688 Southwest Capitol Highway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Holding On to the Sky, February 5th through 7th and 12th through 14th, 8 p.m. at the Peninsula Odd Fellows Lodge in Portland. Holding On to the Sky is an original play about earthquake preparedness, which weaves together stories of disaster, gentrification, health access, addiction, recovery, and resilience. Again, that's Holding On to the Sky, February 5th through 7th and 12th through 14th, 8 p.m. at the Peninsula Odd Fellows Lodge, 4834 North Lombard Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thank you, Billy Bragg, his version of Revolution. Count me in, out, in, out, in, out. This is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. And this is, I think the fourth straight program I've been dealing with this endless situation out at the Malheur Refuge. There's still four people holed up there. And kind of hard to tell exactly what's going on in their minds or at the refuge. As you're probably well aware, the leadership was arrested and or killed. One person was killed, Lavoie Finicum. And yours truly, along with my reporter colleague who was out there with for a week, ended up right behind the shootout, and we didn't even know it. But that's another story. So we are going to talk a lot deeper about this issue and what I call Deep History and American Empire, Reflections on the Bundys, Manifest Destiny, and Left-Right Politics. And our guest is Anthony Hall, a professor of globalization studies at the University of Lethbridge in Alberta, Canada, and a member of the 9/11 Truth Movement. Prior to his position in Globalization Studies Department, he was a professor in the Department of Native Studies. In 2001, Hall organized an academic conference on Indigenous rights coinciding with the Third Summit of the Americas in Quebec City. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police questioned him about his activities, which the Canadian Association of University Teachers called a violation of his academic freedom. He has written a book published in 2003 called American Empire and the Fourth World, which he'll be discussing here. He's also written a book called Earth into Property in 2010, describing the disastrous effects of capitalism on Indigenous peoples. And some people, according to his Wikipedia entry, have called him a conspiracy theorist. And I'm sure he'll have some things to say about that, too. I'm just going to read a brief introduction. The occupation of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge in eastern Oregon has brought widespread attention to long simmering and occasionally boiling over conflicts over federally owned and managed public lands in the West. Competing ideologies, such as states' rights versus federal control, private property rights versus public land management, quote, free market access versus environmental regulation, etc., echo debates and conflicts that go back to the founding of the United States in some cases. As I said, my guest is Anthony Hall, professor of globalization studies at Lethbridge University in Canada. His book, American Empire and the Fourth World, looks at how the United States continued and expanded the British imperial project. The crucial period of the Seven Years' War leading up to the War of Independence established an expansionist U.S. culture of private property, commerce, and ruthless corporate capitalism. In his analysis, the Royal Proclamation of 1763, which established a line and limit to colonial settlement at the crest of the Appalachian Mountains, was key to understanding these developments. The Bundys and their associates see themselves as the true heirs to the, quote, American Revolution. It's debatable whether it was actually indeed a revolution. And the vision of the, quote, founding fathers as embodied in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and to them ordained by God. And they have acted boldly and decisively on the basis of those beliefs. Meanwhile, many on the left do not have such a strong foundation of political belief and religious faith, especially with the erosion or dissipation or destruction in many cases of Marxist-based movement building, revolutionary or otherwise. In my last program by phone from Burns, I made an analogy between the Bundy gang's view of federal control of public lands in the West and the colonial settlers' attitude toward the Royal Proclamation, seemingly ancient history. Me and my guest, Anthony Hall, will use that as a starting point for this conversation. To the extent that anyone still wants to carry the torch of anti-imperialism today in the face of the post 9/11 global war on terror and massive mass surveillance and crackdown, it might behoove us to clearly understand the deep historical roots of United States empire building. And perhaps Professor Hall's work might help in that effort. With all that lengthy introduction, thank you for wading through that. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, Paul.
How are you this morning?
Great, and I just want to acknowledge the hard work you've done and the very thoughtful way that you've woven together historical and contemporary issues, which I think is very important that we get into this, as you call it, deep history beneath the news of the day.
Yeah, that phrase deep history is kind of how I actually got in touch with you through the miracle of modern electronic communication. I was up really early one morning, and I just sort of had this phrase, deep history, came to my mind because, you know, I'm into deep ecology and depth psychology and other such things. And so I put it in the old search engine and came up with Peter Dale Scott, which is an interesting coincidence. And I think, I don't know if it was that or then adding Royal Proclamation, I came upon you, who I had not actually heard of, and your book. And so I got in touch with you, and here we are. So what's your take on deep history and maybe Peter Dale Scott as well?
Well, Peter Dale Scott, interestingly, is a Canadian. He's written about, you know, the deep state. He looked at the assassination of Kennedy in a deep way and discovers that beneath the surface of things, there are secret relationships, transactions that really don't register on what we're told is happening. And he gets into the drug trades, the pipelines in Eurasia. Of course, he got into 9/11 and the deep state politics beneath 9/11. We have a kind of constant global war on terror now, you know, where Muslims are made to seem to be the enemy. We see, you know, terrible crimes against human rights in Syria, and U.S., of course, is backing the Islamic State in many ways, as is Turkey, as is Saudi Arabia, as is Qatar. And we go and we look over to Oregon, and we start to see that this federal authority that the Bundys and Lavoie Finicum and others have been condemning, people are pointing at this out-of-control U.S. federal authority, whether it comes to the abuses that are taking place. Really, it's the abuse of the federal authority by Wall Street, and through that, the abuse of average Americans. So we see all over the world people pointing fingers at the sort of genocidal, aggressive warfare policies of the United States. But now within the United States, we've seen the Occupy movement, we've seen Black Lives Matter, and the group that occupied the Malheur Wildlife Reservation, associated with the name Bundy. I mean, what do you call it? Do you call it militia? Do you call it patriot? In any case, it's a movement of people who are condemning the federal authority to the extent that they are actually taking over federal territory, going into the Constitution and saying this is somehow unconstitutional. The four people inside the headquarters of the federal authority on the Wildlife Reservation, I want to point out that the Clive and Bundy has registered some kind of legal document saying that we continue to maintain some kind of proprietorship or control of that base. So there's a legal dimension that just came into process yesterday that should be understood. Of course, it's a great pleasure really to address a group in Portland, Oregon. I've been involved in legal proceedings there in the case of USA versus Pittawonicut, which Pittawonicut won the case against USA and is living under the protection of the U.S. government from the Canadian government when it concerns Indian land title in British Columbia. So I'm delighted that you were able to see the connections going back to the 18th century. And when we talk about federal abuses of people, of course, the biggest history of this federal abuse of aggressive expansion into human rights and is the assault on indigenous people, the Indian Wars, and the way that the United States expanded from 13 colonies along the eastern seaboard across the continent. This is really classic imperialism, a kind of indigenized imperialism of the settler people. The U.S. was not founded really in an inclusive way. We see this phrase, we the people, but the we the people that was referred to in 1776 did not include black slaves. It did not include the people we now call Native Americans. It was pretty much a Protestant thing. Even to be Roman Catholic, you didn't have the franchise in the early days of the United States. It was a white man's Protestant, and literally man's Protestant, pretty much charter group. So the USA, you know, is not founded on the great, wisdom and insight that might be attributed to it by the people calling themselves patriots, who I see a lot of merit in some of their individuals and some of the arguments they're bringing forward. I mean, in the founding document of the United States, the Declaration of Independence, it goes into a condemnation of King George, and it gets down to these words, exactly these words. King George did bring on the merciless Indian savages, whose known means of warfare is undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. So I like to say that the global war on terror really didn't start on 9/11. It more started on July the 4th, 1776. And this condemnation, this racial profiling of merciless Indian savages as a group of essentially terrorists who would, you know, do indiscriminate damage and violence on all ages and sexes and conditions, women and children, for instance. This should ring out, and we should look at this when we talk about the wisdom of the founders. And when it says King George did bring on the merciless Indian savages, well, what did he do to bring on the merciless Indian savages? Well, he kind of sided with the Indians. The British imperial government was kind of reaching out to the Indians and saying, you join the British Empire, join British North America, but there will be some protections for you in law. And we will create a line, and we will say, you know, settlers can't just go into your territory and kill you and take it over. There will be, you know, regulation of that border. And if at any time any of the said Indians, this is in 1763, should be inclined to dispose of the said lands, the same shall be purchased for them at some public meeting. In other words, there has to be negotiations. There has to be Indian consent for the Western expansion into the territories designated by the Royal Proclamation, the so-called Indian hunting grounds. And so I believe the United States was essentially founded in opposition to the Royal Proclamation of 1763, that what we now call the American Revolution, but was really more like a civil war within the British Empire with a secessionist faction. What was the motivation to secede from the British Empire? Well, land speculators, pioneer farmers, people wanted to move west and acquire the lands that they thought they'd won in the French and Indian War. And if Indians were in the way, so be it. Pay them off, kill them. But anyway, don't hold back this God-given manifest destiny of Western expansion.
So these
issues continue to resonate, and I look at this, of course, from the point of view of Canada. And, you know, these were also founding acts of my country. And I sort of embrace the fact in Canada we emerge from the history of the fur trade. And even to this day in British Columbia, the rules of the Royal Proclamation of 1763, which were sort of denied and disliked, and, you know, they're finally being applied in British Columbia, where treaties are being negotiated to this day. And that's how Pittawanaquit found its way to Portland, because there was the belief that a certain sellout faction of Indian people is sort of being paid and bribed to carry on an appearance of negotiations, but it's kind of a fixed and rigged deal that gives up the major claims of sovereignty that First Nations have never left. So I saw I'm studying these issues with respect to the occupation of the Wildlife Center, and I started to become aware of this gifted individual, this very eloquent individual by the name of Lavoie Finicum. And I saw him in the basement of the federal headquarters looking at all the artifacts of the Paiute people and saying, well, these should be returned, there should be some communications, and he invited Paiute people and other Native Americans to begin a dialogue. And he, in another clip, I discovered said that he grew up on the Navajo reservation, and you know, started to talk in what to me conveyed a real sense of background and understanding that the Bureau of Indian Affairs, like the Bureau of Land Management, both under the Interior Department, that Indian people in the way they've been abused by that Bureau, and rancher people who feel abused by the Bureau of Land Management, that there's common ground there, or at least it should be discussed.
Okay, well, I just want to break in because you've given us a lot to chew on there, and I think we need to parse some of these things out. And we have a couple callers. I ask you to wait just a few more minutes so I can respond to a couple things you said.
Yeah.
So there's a number of things that we agree on. I think there's some things we may not agree on, and I think it's I had you on because I think it's important to bring out all these issues because, you know, I think a lot of people are just sort of, you know, demonizing these horrible people who took over the refuge. And I disagree with the takeover myself, but I think the tendency to just sort of, those people are like these mysterious, strange people, other people who are doing this and without actually seeing them as products of this history that we're talking about, at which we are all products of. And to say that they are like somehow fundamentally different from any of us, I think is a dangerous illusion. So the issue of the Paiutes, I think it's really important to ask whether any of them actually tried to talk directly to the Paiutes, and or whether that was sort of just a grandstanding occasion, which I kind of tend to think it was, and also that the Paiutes themselves, have not condemned them. They work closely with the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. I think there's some things that I'm not sure how much you actually know about all this, but you know, a lot of from what I understand, and if there's anybody out there who knows more, please call in to 503-231-8187. But there's a lot of Native tribes who don't actually have the capacity to currently deal with a lot of those artifacts. So they would actually rather that the federal government curate them. Although on the other hand, there are a lot of artifacts that are still being held by the Smithsonian, by universities, by private individuals that do need to go back. So it's a very complex situation. I just think we need to take into account the complexity. And also, you know, there's been very anti-Native statements made by some of those people. Finicum might be different from the others. I don't know that. Unfortunately, we will never know that because he was killed. So anyway, I just want to bring up a few of those points to start with.
Yes. Would you like me to respond?
Yes, please.
Or go right to the caller. Well, I think the points you raise are important. I do believe that Lavoy Finicum, you know, who emerges as this giant figure who I have called and written about as an assassinated person, you know, I was studying his comments. I was drawn into it by an intervener who said, you know, look at these, don't bring your stereotypes that these are, you know, rednecks and racists and gun-toting kind of extremists, like, drop those stereotypes and try to look into the reality of who these people are and the diversity of people. And this Lavoy Finicum, I got drawn into it because of the issue of the artifacts and such, but then I started to look at different clips. And you can look at clips and you can say, well, I don't know about him, but we can find out a lot about him because he was being very outspoken on many issues. And for instance, you know, he publicly took down the surveillance camera over this wildlife reserve, over the protest camp, as I would call it, and brought the camera down and then addressed the cameras and explained the surveillance state. And, of course, in an era when an American patriot, if I could call him that, Edward Snowden, has to live hiding in a way in Russia, away from the sort of ruthlessness of the U.S. government that doesn't want anybody telling that it's spying on us and how deeply it's spying on us and how, you know, any sense of our human rights to have some private sphere is, you know, being violated. against the law, essentially, by, you know, the NSA and by Google, and, you know, it's a police state situation. So he, you know, by doing that symbolic act, he's addressing an issue of federal incursions that go beyond the Paiute, it goes, you know, goes beyond this group or that group. And I really do feel that the way we slice and dice ourselves, the way we say, okay, well, you're in the Occupy movement here, and you're in Black Lives Matter here, and you're in the peace movement, and of course, you know, George Soros actually does fund a lot of these things to create sort of a controlled opposition. Like, you can criticize the government, but only to a certain extent. And if you go into, say, an issue like 9/11, you're going to lose your funding. And then over here we have on the right the libertarians, and we have the Ron Paul people, and then we have, you know, various degrees. You know, we have the Pacific Patriot Network, which is a little bit more moderate than other groups. And other groups, we have Blaine Cooper, you know, emerging as a new voice for me, and he condemned McCain in a meeting and said, you know, he should be on trial for treason for what's going on in Syria. We need to find ways to reach out to one another, that we're never going to deal with this sickness, this malady, this ruthlessness that of what do we call it, the banking cabal at the top, which sort of transcends nationality. But the U.S. nation, the U.S. country, of course, has been an instrument of global assault on human rights around the world. So I thought it's important to try to look at the shared humanity of other people who maybe don't share left progressive views on some issues, who have religious motivation. The Mormon Church figures very centrally in this, and I'm really interested in exploring that. I live in southern Alberta, where, you know, the LDS community here is important, and even there I find myself running into possible prejudices in my own mind. And Lavoie Finicum, it seems to me, embodied kind of a credible image, where the mystique or the aura of the American patriot would meet with the sort of God-fearing Mormon idea of a patriarch. You know, he has 11 children. He brought up 50 children, you know, foster children. He's a mentor to many young people suffering addictions and that kind of thing. It seems to me Lavoie Finicum was, you know, kind of the best embodiment of some of these core ideals of the founding of the United States. And to me, there's little doubt that he was targeted specifically because his words were so effective, because he's educated, because he could picture the larger situation. He was taken out purposely, and I think the, you know, this creating of an ambush, the bringing in of, you know, maybe even hundreds of sharpshooters, you know, obviously this would have to be handled out of the White House. Obviously Barack Obama would have to have a sign off on a operation as elaborate as this.
Okay, we're going
to pull him into the snow, into the bush, and then assassinate him and put him on camera while he's being shot. The car was already being shot. Shauna Cox gives incredible detail to the awfulness of what transpired at the end. To, you know, what mind games are, what's this latest psyop? I have to say, Raw Story, you know, seems to be giving the government version of things. I don't see Raw Story as a credible source on this. Although they are giving out information, Raw Story right away jumped on the evidence of Mark McConnell, the police plant, who had a lot to do with setting this up. And, you know, right away there's this meme that he was charging the cops. I'm really suspicious about the way the media is handling this. And even my own work at Veterans Today, I got pushed off that site for trying to tell the story of Lavoie Finicum.
Okay, we're going to have to, you've given us a whole bunch to take in again, and I'm sure you're going to raise quite a bit of controversy. I personally, you know, I'm having you on because I think this is an important voice to hear. I haven't actually gone into it enough to say I know anything at all to be able to agree or disagree with what you're saying about Lavoie Finicum. I tend to, by my own personal formation tend to be somewhat distrustful of these large patriarchal Mormon families. But again, as you're saying, that could be my prejudices as well. And I do think that it is important to sort of break out of the boxes that we're in. But I think maybe some of our callers might have something to say. So let's go to Sunny.
Hi, good morning. Interesting, important discussion. Well spoken. Lots of things to think about. And I'm calling to perhaps bring in a word that I think will help in all directions, I think. Along with the Paiute being the original people over there and the treaties that were not honored and et cetera in relation to them, the foundation of freedom that went into the Constitution, much of it came from the original people of this country, and as Indians, we love freedom. And when the people came over here from Europe, many of them my own ancestors also, they were impressed by the fact that Indian people had elected chiefs, not monarchies. And just because somebody was a chief and maybe they passed on didn't mean that their son or daughter came along to start telling people what to do. And also people voted on war and all sorts of things. And this really would make an impression upon people that came from a land where there was much suffering under that totalitarian monarchy. Some of my own ancestors played a role in impressing upon the people that are called the founding fathers these things, and some of my own ancestors are mentioned to good account by Thomas Jefferson and the others, that they did make an impression. And that's because the larger freedom that our people crafted through much discussion, much democracy, was important and is still important. And the document that came out of it all, though the element that crafted it was not perfect, is still a very, very important document and warrants that everyone is heard, that we do stand and listen and sit and listen and talk and use our freedom of speech and honor all of the rights in the document and stand with it with good hearts. Keep good hearts and go forward. And I hear this man, what he is saying, that there's some important things to look at, but it does not mean we have to embrace all, nor does it mean we have to walk away. It does mean that freedom requires us to put in the work, use our minds, use our hearts, and to stand by it. And so that's all I have to say.
Well, thank you very much for that.
I'd love to respond.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, talk about well-spoken. Thank you very much for that. And I think I understand the history, some of the history that is being referred to here. The Longhouse League, the Iroquois League, the Haudenosaunee, you know, this is the most famous confederacy, really, in the Americas, and their constitution, the Great Law, was a big influence on many people. Benjamin Franklin was quite interested in it, and of course it's been written about and it's been translated, you know, the founding of the Longhouse League by Daganoweda and Hiawatha, and so in the 1980s, the U.S. Congress did acknowledge that the federal idea in the United States does draw on this Longhouse Confederacy. And the Longhouse Confederacy gave rise to kind of a covenant chain, they called it, between the different colonies. It was centered in New York. And this Sir William Johnson, who was essentially the author of the Royal Proclamation of 1763, he was an expert. You know, he spoke Mohawk. His family was partly Mohawk. He and Molly Brandt had a number of children. And so he was kind of taking in on the French approach to Indian people, which is, you know, let's be friends and let's do business and let's And he was an imperialist, and the Royal Proclamation of 1763 is a British imperial document, but the idea is let's have Indian alliances, let's make some kind of recognition of the shared humanity of Indian people. So the fact that the United States does draw on this example and this federal example that is so prominent in the way the so-called patriots refer to, you know, well, this is Oregon, and it's Oregon that is sovereign. Well, that was the argument leading up to the Civil War. It wasn't about slavery initially. It was about states' rights. And to me, in Canada, you know, when provincial governments say, well, we own the resources and we give out whatever land titles, I don't like it. I'd like to see a strong federal authority. And the theory is the federal authority is supposed to be protecting Indian people from the incursions coming from the more local governments and the businesses they operate. But let's look at the reality of what we say, okay, the Paiute said this, or, you know, let's broaden the scope a little bit and say, you know, right now the way it's structured, many of these reservations are sort of 90% dependent on federal transfer payments. The American law has set it up so that Indian chiefs are kind of mayors of municipal corporations, and they're on the payroll of the federal government, and they exercise the authority of the federal government. So, you know, there has been a big process within Native American people where the American Indian movement, of course, emerged and said, you know, this federal system of governance under the Bureau of Indian Affairs is not our own. We are sovereign. This case in Portland that I was involved with, this was a Mohawk freedom fighter by the name of Splitting the Sky, is now dead. He was the person with whom I was working. He was in prison for 20 years. He was involved. He was charged with killing a cop at Attica, and you know, AIM emerges from the prisons, the reality that indigenous peoples, you know, find their way into the prisons in disproportionate number, and colonized people around the world are often in prisons. And the American Indian movement emerged to condemn not only the federal government, but those Indian people who were getting too cozy with the federal government. And, of course, this came to a kind of civil war head at the Pine Ridge Reserve, and the chief there, you know, was condemned as empowering a group of sort of FBI-backed thugs.
Tribal council chairman, Dick Wilson,
killed,
yeah.
FBI members, including Anna Mae Aquash, a Mi'kmaq person. Anyway, this is history that comes to the fore at this moment, and it should be given careful consideration.
Okay, well, let's go to another caller. Johnny, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I would like to just touch base and maybe hear some reflection on the first peoples that came over theoretically or supposedly with Columbus, and the nature of their standing in society led to believe that a lot of these peoples that were brought over to create the colonies or to start establishing the colony were folks of lower standing of society. They were criminals and just ruffians and like hardcores, and there were just a few appointed officials, Jefferson and people of this nature, to theoretically guide them. And what that looks like upon their projections in Native American societies, and how atrocities may have been served in that light. And also I want to touch base on the American Indian movement. James Means has a brilliant documentary for listeners out there who want a little bit more of the information about the American Indian movement. There's a documentary out there called Welcome to the Reservation, and it's about all of America pretty much being turned into a reservation. And third and last final, I'd like to touch base on Malheur and just kind of point out like the deep energetic value of what is being played out. And if you take a look at the universe and the guidance of energetic forces, positive over negative, all all things, whether they are bad or good, have a little bit of good in them, and nobody really has control. Great Spirit Creator has complete and total control over everything. And if we look at, you know, there are people who serve Creator and don't even know it, and are sent on missions for reasons beyond their understanding. And to kind of see into what light is being brought out of the Malheur incidents. And if you could just touch base on a couple of those things, that would be great.
Okay. Well, that last point is, I'll just let it stand. I'm not sure exactly.
Well, of course, I hear, there's an effusion of... is it spirituality or religion that, this is a very powerful force in history, this manifest destiny to which you refer to in the title of our talk today. I mean, this is a manifest destiny that God did divine the United States to do this larger mission in the world. And this really goes back to the way the United States was founded by a kind of extremist group of Protestants who were persecuted in Calvinist Protestants who were persecuted in Europe and came and founded, most famously Mississippi, the Puritan founders. And of course the Puritans, Cromwell would represent this Puritan ideal and sort of empire build in taking over the British monarchy in Europe. But in the United States, there is no United States. In New England, there's this concept of doing God's work, of being God's chosen people, of creating a new Jerusalem, of coming to the promised land. And, of course, this is Calvinist Protestants who see that heaven is only open for a certain few, a certain chartered group, a chosen people. And they're reading the Old Testament, of course, and what's going on between the United States and Israel should be understood, and Christian Zionism should be understood in relationship to this common preoccupation with the founding principles of the Old Testament, really. And Australia is a prison colony, but the United States has a different history. And of course, like Roger Williams, who founded Rhode Island, he was a dissenter against the Puritans, the Puritan patriarchs, and he said, no, we're going to reach out to the Indians, the Narragansett Indians, and he made a treaty with the Narragansett Indians to found Rhode Island, and he's he did a dictionary, and he sort of made the principle that, look, just the king giving you a charter, that's not good enough. We have to go to the Indians. And William Penn, who founded Pennsylvania, famously a Quaker, and his Quaker community reached out to the Delaware and made a treaty. And there's a famous Benjamin West painting, a kind of propaganda painting, that the British Empire would make treaties with the indigenous.
And of course, Penn's sons actually went back on the Delaware and the Shawnee and actually ended up selling a lot of their land out from under them. But it's a very rich and complex history you're bringing up. I think I really appreciate all the points you've made. Let's see what our guest Anthony has to.
Lauren.
Okay. Well, let's go to our next caller, and then we'll have Anthony going. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hi. I wanted to make two statements. One regarding the artifacts, and I wanted to clarify, I'm a Native American, I'm Navajo, from the Southwest New Mexico. I grew up on the reservation, I'm eight generations strong of Native American, who, we are still struggling with being occupied by the federal government. We don't have no freedoms. We live on reservations that are extremely poor. The gentleman brought up artifacts. We as a Native people, we are still trying to recover some of our ancient artifacts. There's been countless of reports in the news about our items going up in auction in Paris. and this is happening all over the world. A lot of people are using the Native Americans' story as justification for this atrocity that's happening in Oregon. And I'd like to say, as a Native person, we are still struggling for our freedoms. How dare anyone use our history with the government to justify what's going on? These gentlemen that are talking about the forefathers and how welcoming they were to the Native people, that is wrong. A lot of people forget our history. We still have lots of people who are suffering, and it makes our heart hurt. And it's very sad to listen to some of these people. I gotta go. I'm really sorry.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I appreciate your being able to call in and share that with us. Anthony, do you have any response to our previous two callers?
Well, that was a very heart-rendering intervention and a very important intervention. I do want to suggest, however, in response to that last comment, heartfelt comment, that, you know, we share a lot of history, and to say this is our history and not your history, well, you know, we look at these historical developments and we all have some, it resonates with us in different sides of, from different sides of the frontier, say. So the idea that the founding of the United States, now the United States was a taking up arms against an authority, the British Imperial Authority. It was a people's movement to take up arms and take the Indian land. And no, there is no founding, you know, great reaching out to the indigenous peoples. The Indian Wars are, you know, legendary around the world, and it signals that this United States authority that is being created is going to be an aggressive, expansionary authority. And, you know, the U.S. now is the most armed, weaponized polity the world has ever known, and, you know, nuclear submarines and pointing weapons at us from all angles, and secret research and weapons, and it's out of control. And this Western aggression towards indigenous peoples was sort of the roots of the military-industrial complex. So let's not romanticize that the United States is somehow founded in some reaching out to the native people. Au contraire, I think the Canada, we could kind of make that case, because the Royal Proclamation is kind of the roots of our country, and it's also at the roots of the United States. I do believe that all this stuff about representation and taxation, and, well, what were people being taxed for? To protect and uphold this principle of the Royal Proclamation that the Indian territory should be separate from the settler colonies, and this was unacceptable.
Well, people were being taxed.
Franklin was first and foremost a land speculator, and George Washington was a land speculator. And, you know, there was a lot of crooked, underhand dealings and trying to buy land from Indians and bribe Indians and, you know, intimidate them and get them drunk. And, you know, it's a terrible, ugly history. And, you know, George Washington was really into Indian land speculation, as was Benjamin Franklin. So, you know, we need to get down to, you know, beneath the sort of mystical aura and look at what our real situation is in history. Deep history.
And of course, you know, that it's also important to recognize that, you know, sure, it's all related, but some of the taxation that people were fighting against, you know, the stamp tax, the tea tax, whatever, there were taxations being imposed precisely for the same reason that we have the same debates today, that they were waging these imperial wars, the France, Austria, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, England, the Great Britain, they were all fighting with each other in various alliances for, you know, for decades, centuries, and it drained the royal treasuries. And so, of course, they were having to tax the people. The reason why taxation hit the colonists perhaps differently was because they were so far from the royal authority, they felt, you know, that they were— You know, they had a different relationship. You know, the whole imperial structure created these, you know, these imbalances of power and representation and direct, you know, feeling directly connected to the authorities, whatever. It's a very complex thing. You know, so you have this whole series of independence movements from the empire because the periphery, you know, either wants to be directly free in the case of, you know, the African colonies and to a certain extent in the Latin American colonies. And there's also a mixture of what happened in the United States, where you had actually the colonists themselves declaring their own civil war, their own freedom, and then immediately imposing their own will and oppression on the indigenous people. I don't think that was particularly coherent, but that's my take.
Let's remember that in Boston Harbor, was it in 1774, at the so-called Tea Party, the Boston Tea Party, the people who were throwing tea overboard were dressed up as Mohawks. And why would they dress up as Mohawks? I think it refers to what a previous caller mentioned, that the example of Native American freedom did infuse into the settler population. So by putting on the dress of Mohawks, of course, you know, that might have been so they don't get recognized. But the Tea Party movement, in fact, you know, has this roots of, we dressed in Indian gear, and what are they saying? What were those initial people saying? And, of course, this was not the conservatives. The conservatives were those who were siding with the Indians. I mean, my country's history, Red Tories, you know, going back to this author of the Royal Proclamation, Sir William Johnson, to me, this is true conservatism. And the conservatism of the United States is kind of skewed. There's something wrong with it because of the founding of the United States was, you know, a Whiggish liberal rejection of the British imperial principles. The British imperial principles being, you know, including the idea that Indians are going to be part of the British Empire and they're going to have, you know, some protections of law. Now we're having the protections of law stripped off all of us. We do no longer see federal authority as having some protections for average people. It's an instrument of, you know, not only the 1%, but the 0.11, you know, 62 people owning the same as the bottom 3.6 billion people. The federal authority does not provide protections of law for Indian people, for average American people. Certainly most people in the world identify more with the Indians, who see imperialism and Zio-American imperialism and as it presently is today, sort of coming at them as a force coming at them. All these people fleeing for their lives from you know, the Iraq, Syria area, going into Europe, destabilizing Europe. You know, that this is a very cynical move. This is being engineered. This isn't happening as a force of nature. This was an anticipated outcome. You know, there is a movement to destabilize Europe with this huge forced migration. This is the USA fighting both sides, creating ISIS, arming ISIS, creating Al-Qaeda, you know, making Al-Qaeda into patsies on 9/11, creating this new version of the global war on terror, Barack Obama's version, you know, we'll replace Al-Qaeda with this other U.S. proxy force. We'll work through Saudi Arabia like we did with Al-Qaeda. We'll work through Qatar. We'll work through Turkey. But we'll also, you know, actually send IS arms. And you know, I comment for Press TV in Iran fairly often, and I get good reports about U.S. being caught in different ways, arming Islamic State, Israeli hospitals, giving health care to Al-Qaeda. You know, this whole global war on terror that is trying to make us, you know, be petrified of Muslims and Muslim extremism. You know, this is a psychological operation, and this Ratzheimer, the person working with Geller, at the camp, at the occupation. You know, we're being played and sliced and diced in so many ways.
Okay,
we need to also address Islamophobia and the Islamophobia industry.
Okay, we only have about 5 minutes left. I gotta cut you off because we this is a talk show and we still have a couple callers I'm hoping to squeeze in. And it's going by very fast. We've introduced so many subjects. I don't think there's a chance, even a prayer of like bringing them all together in a sort of a neat way that I'd hope to do. But let's go to our next caller, Boris. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yeah.
I would like to address one singular issue and then get your guest response to it. And what I'm talking about is my assessment of the blatant, stark double standard in the way that the authorities are treating these occupiers in Malheur, as opposed to, let's say, we have historical precedents for this. If, in fact, the Black Panthers had taken it over in the case of armed occupation, or even more stark, if forest activists had taken it over unarmed, totally peaceful, the way that either one of those two groups would have been treated by the federal government versus the way these so-called patriots are being treated. And my assessment of the situation is this. There's really an underlying issue here, and that issue is the privatization of public domain. And I think your guest might agree with me that in the final analysis, the entity that gives marching orders to the U.S. military and to law enforcement across the nation is, in fact, the plutocracy / corporatocracy. And if you look at the situation at Malheur, what these occupiers are, whether they are witting or unwitting, they are pawns towards this end, the privatization of public domain. And the plutocracy couldn't be happier with that kind of process. And I submit to your guest that that's the reason they're being treated with such, you know, deference, and why it took so long for anything to happen. If they had been Black Panthers, I think it would be easy to see that they would have been crushed immediately, and the deaths that would result would be simply written off as, you know, the appropriate action to be taken against terrorists. So I'd like to hear what your guest has to say about that.
Well, I don't disagree with anything you're saying, you know, I do fear that we get into this sort of division, that it plays into the idea that, okay, we see a separation and we empathize with this group and we condemn this group of so-called patriots, as you put it. Let's remember that this group, in a way, embody sort of the core constituency of the Republican Party right now. Yes, you know, the United States is a racist country, and these people who are emerging and saying we're patriots, I mean, they credibly do create a symbol of the people that all the Republican candidates for presidency, you know, are trying to attract. And let's be clear that we're in an election year here. This is highly political, what is taking place. And I must say that I never could really get it with the Bundys, but when I heard this Lavoie Finicum, and now Lavoie Finicum has been sort of assassinated in the public square, or crucified essentially, he's made to seem, well, maybe he was reaching for his gun and ta-da, ta-da, like the man was assassinated in cold blood by, you know, 100 sharpshooters who were shooting at the car, shooting up the federal government did act with terrible, terrible aggression and, you know, completely nonsensical. What was he going to do in 3 feet of snow standing there in the middle of the bush? You know, oh, no, we just had to take him away.
But I think Boris's point is well taken.
Case to be made that what about the failure to empathize with this assassination and to sort of downplay it? If it had been Fred Hampton shot on, you know, with his hands up, would the same thing be taking place? So I think, yes, racism is a part of this, and there is different treatment afforded to different groups, but that doesn't take the responsibility of us, the citizens, we the people, to see the humanity of everybody, regardless of their color, their religion, their background, to understand that we all have our different ways to understand this federal aggression upon us, this bankers' cartel that has made the federal government of the United States its tool, and the armaments companies and all, and that we have to come together in some way to find a way to throw off the weight of this tyranny. And the way that people perceive it and identify it might be different, but it is tyranny, and we are being enslaved, and we have to find a way to liberate ourselves.
Okay. That is going to have to be pretty much the last word. I'm sure lots of people have a lot to say about this. You've stirred up a very interesting pot. I really appreciate that. I would have liked to have said a few more things about exactly what Boris was talking about, who's also kind of behind the scenes in terms of the ideological roots of them, the American Lands Alliance, Storm Over Rangelands conference has just happened in Boise, Idaho, the ideological roots of the Oregon standoff, and so much more, but we have to end. So thank you so much, Tony. I really appreciate your being with us.
Constitution, well, you know, they'll want to change your head. And the institution, well, you know, better free your mind instead. Go kind, pick your chairman, Mal. Gonna make it anyhow.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Community Acupuncture and Massage, a benefit for political prisoner Mutulu Shakur, Sunday, February the 7th, noon to 4 p.m. at 7 Star Acupuncture in Portland.